I would like to preface my story by saying what I'm about to speak to, despite the story I'm about to tell, the people who raised me did the best they could. Well, because I think as I will unfold this story that I speak to the commonality of all of us in what we experience. And I want this story to be told in absolute humility, because it's not about me or my story. It's to connect and relate with other people.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode on the Stretch Street podcast. This is the Energetic EJ, and you already know what I'm going to say. Yes, I am delighted to be here again today with another episode and with another guest on the show. And today I have a special guest. Of course, all my guests are special. Today, I have Justin McSweeney on the show, all the way from Florida. Yeah, state of Florida. Yeah. I'm going to get to meet my guest today, and we're going to go through a journey into his story and, you know, some of the very significant life lessons that life has delivered to him through this challenging situations or stories, so to say. So please pay attention. Don't go anywhere. If this is your first time on this podcast channel, whether you're watching or listening, please do well to subscribe, turn on notifications so that you are alerted every time we put out a new content. Hello, Justin. How are you today?
Hello, Ajiro. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Awesome. And by the way, guys, Justin here is also a podcaster. So yay! This... And I was once a guest on his show. And so I'm super delighted to be the host today. And I'm looking forward to a very interesting conversation. He is the host of IdeaCast. So basically, it's an interview series where he really just, you know, talks to different people across the world. And yeah, tell me a little bit about yourself. Not me, tell us, my audience. Who is Justin? What is something that when they think about you, you want them to remember? Like, if you forget anything I say today, remember this about me.
People might end up remembering me because I have a very strange sense of humor, and I tend to laugh at just about everything. So, but humor is what's kept me going all these years. So,
you and I alike.
Yeah, it's my alchemical tool in my toolbox that keeps me going. So
I love it.
I do feel very welcomed here. You and I, as you mentioned, had another conversation. And in this dialogue, I will have to refrain from asking you questions, and I have to play the guest this time. So, but I very much enjoyed our conversation. Hosting you, yeah, we opened up some good space together, and I found out a lot about you, as did my audience. And so I'm appreciative of that. And I think we're going to recreate that synergy in this conversation as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so we're just having, and we want to get to meet who Justin is. And I know you have a series of, you know, would I call them life, you know, challenges, mm-hmm. And that you have just, you know, been able to flow through, not like flow with the ease. No, I know, like, they're really challenging, but it has really made you the person you are, the kind of thinker you are, the kind of, I think your philosophy or your view of life is not one we come by every day. I remember, you know, when we have these conversations, the way you look at things, the way you believe now, the things you believe now, and these are all, you know, out of the life experiences that you've had. So just take us through a little bit of your story, your background, you know, where you're coming from, and then, you know, tell us, you know, this story of yours.
I'd be happy to do that. And I would like to preface my story by saying what I'm about to speak to is... I consider myself to have led a very blessed and fortunate life. I've lived a good life. I've never had to worry too much about where food is coming from. I've always had good shelter. And despite the story I'm about to tell, the people who raised me did the best they could. And so I don't want this to sound like any kind of an indictment against anybody or a story where I feel like I had taken on life challenges that were... just on a grand scale and insurmountable, because I think as I will unfold this story that I speak to the commonality of all of us in what we experience. And again, I'm just acknowledging that there are people out there who have dealt with a whole lot more than I did. So I'll lay that disclaimer down, because I want this story to be told in absolute humility, because it's not about me or my story. It's to connect and relate with other people. So anyway, having laid down my disclaimer, I will say that much like my generation, I was representative of I am a representative of that generation in that my family life was very dysfunctional in childhood. Parents that had birthed me into this world and raised me were dealing with challenges. They were dealing with things that they inherited from their dysfunctional childhoods and backgrounds. And again, I say that as a disclaimer to not pass judgment on anybody. But nonetheless, there were circumstances that had to be experienced and sorted out. And as I said before we hit record, children have a different way of processing these kind of experiences, whether they're traumatic or tedious or incoherent or Machiavellian, where the parents are you know, behaving in ways that are not necessarily pro-social or ideal for childhood and raising a child. So anyway, they were very dysfunctional, and they finally got divorced when I was about six. And I can remember when my mother came up to me and said, well, you know, we're getting divorced. And she tried to break it to me gently. But the thought in my mind was I was very relieved that they were separating at 6 years old, because of the violence and the fighting in the house was egregious. It was just beyond what any two people should have to do, you know, experience with each other. And I was in the middle of it. So at 6 or 7 years, I was just about to turn seven, you know, I was relieved. And so that speaks again to this thing. And I didn't feel sorry for myself. I was sentimental. I was sad that, you know, this classic, you know, nuclear family was going to dissolve. But anyway, I got through it. And it worked out good, because then I would do weekends with my father and spent the rest of the week with my mom. And so it was kind of, you know, a nice way to go back and forth. But again, they had their demons and they were dealing with things. And again, this is not an indictment, but it made an impact on me, made an impression on me. And I had to deal with that. And as another thing I noted before we hit record, this is very coarse-grained, very generalized, but when people are either traumatized as children or their imprinting process, their mimetic process is not healthy, that those dysfunctions that are internalized can be expressed in one of two ways. And again, this is very simplified, but we can express it outward into the world. And again, that can show up as narcissism or sociopathy, that we create this narrative about ourselves as being inviolate and perfect, and that the rest of the world is flawed. And, you know, that they're the reason that I am dealing with these challenges. Yeah. So it's an insulating or coping system. The other option is to internalize it and to be self-destructive and you know, self-harming, all those things. And we see that expressed. And perhaps sometimes it's both. Perhaps it oscillates. I don't know. But I chose the path of internalizing, and I chose the right. Yeah. And so that stayed, and it's still in me. But you know, I with self awareness and with
exactly. I was going to say that. Right. Like, now you're more aware.
Yes. Yeah.
What led to your journey of self awareness? Really, like, at what point did you start to notice that this is what the situation was doing to you, or how you were managing it?
Right. Well, decades of self-abuse slowly wore me down. You know? Yeah. And, I was functional and I was capable of navigating life experience as normally as could be imagined. But also so it was a duality. There was also this internal shadow or darkness or anger or whatever you want to call it. And it again manifested a self-destructive behavior when I needed to vent something, or it needed to, you know, like the Jung would call it shadow work. When you need to let the demons out for a little while, it would usually not end well for me, because I would do something stupid or harmful to myself. So, wow. You know, I matured as into adulthood, it managed itself, and I learned other coping means.
Itself? Can you unpack that? How so?
Well, through the maturation process, so that when I entered into my early 20s, I put my energy, my focus into the work that I did. In fact, I was a workaholic. So that was another very subtle form of self-abuse. I never took days off. I worked continuously as a means. You know, the pretext was that I was, you know, ambitious and making the money that I could, given my skill sets in life. And but, you know, it was just a means probably either of escaping or processing that dark energy, that stuff that was never resolved as per what I onboarded as a child. And again, maturity tempered that to an extent, but it was still there. And I owned a couple of businesses, and they had varying degrees of success. None of them failed, but they all had varying degrees of success. And but I would very harshly judge myself for anything, whether it was not, you know, whether it was something I did or not. So I was very, you know, very self-judgmental.
Very critical.
Self-critical, yeah, and unforgiving. I didn't treat others that way. Unfortunately, yeah, that's the thing about the pure internalizer.
Internalizing thing.
Yeah,
oh,
I could be very confrontational and aggressive with people I didn't like or have respect for. And that's something that was a fault of, you know, one of my shadowy things that, you know, I'm not proud of, but hey, I never got into all out fist fights, but I'm sure I annoyed a bunch of people because I can be very, very aggressive and very, very confrontational when I was younger. I've mitigated that for the most part now. So unless somebody really, you know, eggs me on, but
like really that
everybody does. Everybody has their switch, right? You know, it just goes on, and you're like,
and they have
what?
Their limit as well. Like,
yeah,
there's a limit
what?
To how much you push me.
Yeah,
this number's gonna come out.
Yeah, don't make me. It's like the Incredible Hulk. Don't make me angry. You won't like
don't
me.
Don't make me go green.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I, you know, again, I've learned to try to manage that, and that's one thing. I'll do a tangent right here, and I'll say to the audience that. Don't stuff the demons. Don't stuff the shadowy things. And again, I reference Carl Jung. Work with your shadow and bring it out in a healthy way. So go take boxing lessons. Go do something aggressive that's pro-social. So, you know, mountain biking, something that just really forces you to challenge yourself with your environment or get into debates with people, but that on a fair playing field, or learn chess, something that can allow you to pull that
like,
stuff
like
out of you.
Express it like
yeah,
let it out.
Yeah. In a healthy way, in a controlled environment where it's consensual, where the interlocutor or the person that you're engaging with is not going to be, harmed or demeaned in any way, but there are healthy ways in our social
ways
system
of,
and our right in our human community that we do that. And again, it could be martial arts, it could be you know any
there's
of these
this
things.
There's this concept of I think it's like a vent room where you just go and shatter things.
That's good too. I've done that. I've broken things.
You've done
before.
That?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I go out and you know beat things up. Yeah. Take a machete and chop a tree up or something. I'm sorry, tree. It's a weed. Yeah, I've done that before. You know. We have weeds here in Florida, invasive plants. I'm like, and I just chop it up and then I feel better because it's a weed. So, but I don't advocate that.
So when you refer to the healthy way of not letting the shadows in or letting it out, is the criteria is as long as it's not affecting any other person, as long as it's not harmful to any other person and even yourself.
Yeah, so... Correct? It's a discipline that has to be acquired. And yes, you make a very good point that it should not have a negative impact on yourself as well. So in other words, it has to be cathartic. It has to be a way of just releasing the pressure, or releasing the valve so that, you know, you afterwards, and it may build up again, and you have to do it as a cyclical process, but you know, that you feel as though, whatever that gnawing anger, that hunger of feeling like you have to lash out, or you have to, you know, project that trauma out onto somebody else or other, you know, groups of people, that's been satisfied for now and that it's been taken care of. So it's, I don't think it's a means to an end, but I think it's a pressure valve, and it just helps you release. But be aware of that when you're doing it and saying, my gosh, I have this thing within me. And I need to be aware of it. I don't need to eliminate it. And again, I don't need to stuff it down, because then it'll show up in other ways. You know,
and I don't need to deny it as well.
Right.
Have you at any point did you deny that it was there, or did you call it something else, or try to separate yourself from it?
I could be fooling myself, but I think I was pretty aware of it most of the time, because it was so palpable, and you know, I wasn't proud of it, but I wasn't also I wasn't deeply ashamed of it either. So I think for my instance, I was in a relationship with it that I was aware of what's was going on. So I was not doing something and then thinking, well, you know, why are they reacting this way? Yeah, what happened? And why are people mad at me? Why are you mad at me? You know, that kind of thing. I know. Yeah, it's like, I know where that came from. Because again, I grew up in a very shadowy environment. And again, all things considered, it wasn't as bad as a lot of people have had to deal with. But it was still enough for me. And so that all culminated into my mid to late 30s. It got really bad and it was very dark. And I had a brain injury at 41, and it was related to a toxic environment, go figure. Mold in my house had compromised my immune system, and my brain was basically fried by this stuff, black mold. I guess it can be very toxic. And so we cleaned the house up, but I had a neurological breakdown, and it was terrifying, because I thought I was going to be a mental invalid, a vegetable, because I was losing my ability to understand what people were saying or to retain any kind of memory or speak. I could speak, but it was a struggle to form words, and it was a struggle to try to, somebody could, like you and I could be having this conversation, I wouldn't register what you were saying. It was just that bad. Yeah. Wow. So that was one of those pivotal moments in life where I had choices to make, and some of those choices were already made for me by this thing that happened. And I very much appreciated the irony and the symbolism of, I was leading a dark, toxic life. I was very polluted by, this self-loathing and this anger that was going on. Mm. And that coincided perfectly with, or correlated perfectly with, what happened to me physically in the physical environment. Mm. And so that was a years long recovery process. And one thing that came out of that I'm very grateful for is, prior to this experience, I very much loved horticulture and botany. So I would just fill my head with all this botany stuff and horticulture and all that. And a lot of that went out the window when I got sick, but I was able to rehabilitate myself in my property here in Florida. My yard, I had at the time like 115 species of palms. So I would go out after palms. This palm trees. Yeah. And after this, I collect rare palms. I'm an interesting cat.
How large is your yard?
It's not that big. That's the funny thing. My neighbor's probably like, what the heck is he doing? He's putting another one in? He's already got 114. What is he doing?
Building a forest?
I want to hide in the woods. Nobody can find me. I have a very obsessive personality. So when I do something, I overdo it. And I can pin that for now, because I've used that. I've harnessed that. It's like a horse I've tamed, right? But so I'll pin that for later. But anyway, I had this collection, and I would go out and so they call it aphasia when you can't remember a name or a word. And I would look at the tree, and I'd say, because I used to know all the botany names for all of them, and I'd look at the tree and I'd be like, okay. I'd start and I'd walk through the yard and I would recite the names. And that was my brain training to get me back online. But the other thing I did is I fell in love with philosophy, because it's so difficult to understand. And so it took a couple of years, but I picked a couple of philosophers to try to understand. And it was tedious, and it was horrifyingly difficult at first, because again, it's difficult to begin with. And then I had this brain injury. So I really forced myself through that. So I'll unpin that obsessive personality. I just kept like a dog. I just kept going. And so that was, I've been interested in this stuff for probably about 7 or 8 years. And I don't claim to be knowledgeable or good at it, but it's something that I'm passionate about, and I just love taking it in and respecting it. I call myself a hobbyist. I collect the ideas, and I try not to misrepresent them, and just, if I share them, and I'll probably throw a few ideas out, but it's what helped me to recover, and it's what helped me to discover myself, as well as discover ways of looking at the world that I had never done before.
And so on that journey, were you self recovering, or did you have help? Like, was it like a process with help from external help?
Yes, I went to a neurologist, and she couldn't find anything wrong. She thought maybe I'd had an ischemic attack, which is a mini stroke, and nothing was found. Although I did have ataxia and other things like tremoring and things like that that were evident of some kind of neurological injury. But she couldn't find anything. But she found that I had Hashimoto's, which is a thyroid condition. So that may have been part of the problem. And so we found that, at least. And then I went to a couple other doctors, and they're like, I can't help you. It's nebulous. We don't know, And so, and the brain mind is tricky, And so, and I don't think it was psychosomatic in the sense that I was harnessing this thing out of nothing. And, it was a contrived condition. It was very much, felt real to me. So who knows? But anyway, and it still lingers in the background. Like, there's still a little bit of film or a haze over my ability to cognize and think about things. But it's not anything disruptive at this point. But it's a good little reminder to keep me honest. It's like, remember this. Don't so mess up again. Don't do that again, or we'll really hurt you. It's like that taskmaster, that good teacher you had years ago. And they're like, you want to learn again? Try me. Oh, so yeah, there were these points in my lifeline that were what a lot of people would call a dark night. I just call them opportunities, and I can do that in hindsight. At the time, I was like, oh my God, what the heck is going on here? You know, right. And I watch me, why me, you know, all this kind of stuff. And but now in hindsight, I call them, they were my masters that showed up to teach me a valuable lesson and to humiliate me. And when I say humiliate me, I use that in the old sense of the word, which means to ground you, to reattach you to something that is solid and reliable. So they were all blessings. They were all very much blessings. And I, I owe a debt to them. I don't want to ever repeat them, and I wouldn't wish them on anybody, but yeah, it's like they showed up for me, and it changed my trajectory of my life.
Absolutely.
You
mentioned earlier on, like, humor was one of the ways that, you know, you've been able to go. How did that play? How does that play into the story?
Okay, I'll get a little weird on this one. To me, humor is the ability to use your imagination. So the definition of humor is something called incongruity resolution, is the very dry, boring way of saying something's funny. Because when somebody presents a joke to you, there's something going on in that joke that in our minds, it's incongruous. So congruous is like, you know, A plus B equals C, and it flows. And, but you know, a joke that something is set up that doesn't make sense. And then they give you the punchline and then, oh, okay. I get what you just did. You know, there was this paradoxical thing you were doing. So anyway, that's the really weird, nerdy way of saying what humor is. But for me, having the imagination activated and being in wonder and being able to see the possibilities anywhere of something that is of value to you, that brings you a kind of value of satisfaction or whatever you want to call it, is where I find humor. And that now humor for me has boundaries. I don't think humor at other people's expense is funny. I don't, you know, so humor can be refined to a high art where, you know, we just like, you know, I have 115 palm trees in my yard. What's up with that? You know? And it's like, people would just be like, you're crazy. And it's like, yes, I am. And you know, okay. And then we laugh and it's like, yeah, I, it's my pet. It's my weird thing that I do. And it brings me satisfaction, but you know, other people can laugh at it and go, God, guys, what is he? And I'm good with that. So anyway, but yeah, whatever humor is, it to me, it is a, so sometimes they'll say alcohol is a social lubricant and okay. You know, so that's a disinhibition. And so I'd say maybe humor could be a tool for disinhibition. So if you get into a room full of people that nobody knows each other, everything's a little awkward at first, and we need an icebreaker, we need a social lubricant. If a couple of people start talking about something funny that happened to them, like, oh my gosh, you know, this happened. And then everybody's like, oh, and then the pressure comes down and everybody's a little more at ease. And that's the same thing that booze does. And I don't drink booze, but you know, it's like humor is that same kind of... like if everybody has a glass of wine and then they're relaxed a little bit, they're not guarded and they say, oh yeah. And they can be a little more vulnerable.
That's such a funny way to think about alcohol. Like that's kind of like a very alluring way. Like, okay, let's let our guards down.
That's it. Please, let's chill out a little. Yeah. And some people would prefer, you know, a glass of wine over a couple of silly jokes. But like I said, I think it's the same thing. You know, if we're all in a room together and we don't know each other. And I think it shows a common thread. So if we can relate to that funny thing, like something embarrassing happened to somebody at the airport, and then we can all laugh because that could have been me, right?
Yeah.
But they're here and it's fine. And that's the resolution of the incongruity at the airport. And so that, I think, is a tool in your toolbox. If you can have a good sense of humor and if you can laugh at things that may be at your expense or maybe at the expense of something you did that you can learn from, then that helps you with learning because then you can say, oh, I can't take myself too seriously. I can't take that issue or situation or my relationship with somebody so seriously that I have to be offended and upset and hurt. Now, again, I say that with all the necessary caveats that humor should not be used, weaponized to denigrate up, you know, and marginalize people. That's not what it's
absolutely
about.
Absolutely.
That's a antisocial.
It's more like healthy humor.
Right. That we can relate to.
Everything has the healthy and then the dangerous part. So
Shadow and light.
The job here for all of us is just to try as much as we can to ensure that the skill is more to the healthy part than, you know, the destructive part of things. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. So if you were to highlight one, two, three, or a couple of really, you know, significant life lessons for you personally, that this journey, I mean, like, again, I don't know what it is that like brought you to this point where you are almost like you are able to objectify yourself, like you're able to look at the situation objectively. Mm-hmm. And having, you know, I don't know, maybe this came from having spent years and years, you know, just imploding. Now you understand, like, you know what, I can let it go and see the situation for what they are. Because it began with your disclaimer, like, whatever I'm sharing here today, I'm not sharing it so that you can feel pity for me. No, I know that these things happened, but at the same time, I'm not sharing it so that you can, so that I can demonize those around me with what happened, or even at the slightest, you know, opportunity, lay a blame game or play the blame game. But I'm just saying these things happened. These are the result of the things that happened. And these were the way that I was able to deal with it. All still being able to share, you know, some very cogent points right here of one, how trauma can affect a person, and how your reaction, your choices, your decisions can actually affect your loved ones, whether you like it or not. And I just love how you were able to detach yourself from it. Like, how? I would love to know how, if there was a technique to that, because that is a really, really good tool. Is there a technique to that? Before then, I then ask you the next question.
There is, and it came through my diving into the pool of philosophy and swimming around a bit in it. And so everybody's familiar with Buddhism, and I'm not a Buddhist, and I'm not scholarly in Buddhism, but one concept that they work with is they challenge the person to contemplate the nature of self, of selfhood. So this body that you're speaking to is an aggregation of many cells. It is a system, but I can never identify. So this is kind of a Buddhist way of thinking. I can never identify the locus of the self or the center of the self that is me, that is my personality, that is my sense of humor, that is my fears, my hopes, my dreams, ambitions, that is the me that solves problems. There is no way to really find that part, that aspect of the being person, this physical person. So what they're inviting you to do in that sense is to deconstruct yourself in a healthy way, so that the strong attachment to the identity of self, that is your personality, your character, your hopes, your dreams, your ambitions, can be relensed or re-perspectized, perspectively known, I guess is a way to say it. And it's an opportunity to go into a mode of inquiry about, well, who am I? And, you know, what am I made of in the non-physical sense? What am I made of in the mental space, in the psycho-emotional space? And it's never meant to produce answers. It's mostly that it's the inquiry process that's important. And I've done that, again, obsessively. And I've come to the conclusion that although I have an ego, I have personality, I have my faults and my good characteristics, that at the end of the day, I can't take any of it very seriously, because it is a story that's been built up over 54 years. It is a story of me rather than it is a me. It is a story of me. It is all of my stories. And every frame by frame of my moving into the future, I want to have that humility, again, that grounding, to know that I am a composite of my stories. I am a collection of my stories. And I want to use that to the best effect that I can, so that it is absolutely necessary to be a person and to be an identifiable self, a psycho-emotional self. And we have to do that in society and in interactions with others and the environment. I can't walk out in front of a bus because I'm having these, you know, moments of contemplation. You know, I'm going to get killed. So you got to be grounded. You got to stay connected. But at the same time, you can, again, using the imagination or using the space of the imaginal, is explore the idea of, you know, who is that self and who is that person? And can I get to better know that person in this kind of circular sense, like, okay, well, this is an aspect of me. I'm a weird eccentric palm collector. That's a part of me. Where did that come from? Well, I have a love for nature. I love plants. I love, you know, so we can use that tool to understand our know thyself, right? Know ourselves better. And what came to make me as the non-physical person, as the emotional person, as the person that feels and makes decisions and things like that.
Wow.
So I'm not saying that out of any kind of like I've accomplished something. It's more that it's just a simple tool that keeps me, again, grounded in the sense that I could still be obnoxious. I can still be arrogant. I can still have opinions and ideas. But when I catch myself at my better moments in life, I can say, I am so utterly insignificant and I am so utterly capable of doing flawed things that I have to be aware of that. And that helps me to interact with other people on a more honest and good faith perspective. Yeah. So I have my moments where I'm not that good person that's trying to do what I just say. I can be the obnoxious person, but that if I can reel myself in and have these moments. And so when I'm not being that really nice person who's doing all this right, I can catch myself a little faster and go, okay, Justin, you're being a jerk, you know, hold it back, reel it in. And then I'll pull it back and I'll be like, I'm relating with another human being who has their own set of values and their own story that moves frame by frame forward into the future. And that to me helps cultivate a sense of respect for every living person, even the ones dealing with really, you know, they're just monsters, you know, they're really, yeah. I see in that monster that there's
it's
a
just
piece of
you
me.
See it now, like it's just one part of them, it's not like the totality of them, so you're able to like identify or isolate that moment of, could it be psycho and, you know, or stupidity, mm-hmm. or something, like, oh, this person is having a moment.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And you're not like saying this person is a bad bird, like that is so powerful, Justin. That that is so powerful. Wow.
And you see the suffering in them. And then in that suffering, you can elicit an empathy. So there's two types of empathy. There's intellectual empathy to recognize, to say, that person's, you know, malignant. They're antisocial. They're you know, somebody commits a crime and kills somebody or hurts somebody. But there's a backstory to that. And they need to account for what they did. But nonetheless, just demonizing them and turning them into monsters, it won't allow for that ability for all of us as a collective, as a human species or a race or however you want to call it, to ask questions about how do we mitigate that? How do we stop that from happening? How do we raise our children differently? Or how do we set up environments where the children aren't going to turn into those products? So rather than saying, well, that person was a bad seed, let's throw them in prison and they can rot and you're put them to death or whatever. And I, you know, they need to go and go to prison if they've done something, you know, violent or
that
terrible.
Bad, yeah. But we need to still know what
look
led to it.
Yeah.
The things, the thoughts behind it, the emotions behind it, so that we're able to then, you know, guard the society generally, so we don't have a repetition of that all the time. That's so fantastic.
Yeah, and to sum that up, it's more proactive than reactive. So we have to be reactive. We have to say, well, you committed a crime. Guess what? You're going to prison, or you're, you know, whatever. And then the proactive retrospect on that is to say, how can we help people raise their children better? How can we set up the conditions
point.
In our society that can help these children not turn into monsters? Because very few monsters are born. You know, there are people with psychopathy that are in the antisocial spectrum of psychopathy. They are going to go out and cut people up and do bad things from birth. But they're a very, very small segment of the population. Psychopathy is a fair, you know, there are a lot of pro-social psychopathy people in the world, psychopaths, but they end up doing good things. They become lawyers, they become surgeons, they become, you know, military people, and they can turn it off and on. But I always joke, it's like, if I hire an attorney, I want a psychopath, I want a sociopath, but that they have pro-social skills, that they're doing that for the betterment, or a surgeon, that somebody that can cut me open and not flinch and just do what they need to do, you know, and so I'm being a little dramatic, but I think, you know, this is to speak to the idea that there is pro-social and antisocial, and the antisocial is conditioned typically. And again, there are that percentage of our population that are just absolute monsters, but the rest of it, we may have some,
you can learn and unlearn.
Yeah. Yeah, we may have some influence on that.
That's deep. So what are some life lessons that you can share with us on your journey that, you know, these are things that you have learned, and, you know, it's like, these are the things I've learned. You can, you know, maybe gain some inspiration from that, as if you're listening to this podcast.
So again, I'll dip into the philosophy thing that I've been talking about. And I think one thing in particular that might be interesting is to speak to something from Christian scholasticism. And I'm not a practicing Christian, but I find Christian faith to have valuable tools for human navigation of experience and navigation of relation with others. And one thing that I've taken from early scholasticism, I think, or early Christianity, was there were two schools that worked on the idea of knowing God. And the idea of knowing God can be done through cataphasis, by defining God as whatever you would choose to define God as being. And some people would say, well, God is a man, God is this, God is that. But the apophatics would turn around and say, I know not what I'm engaged with. I only know when I'm in the presence of the divine. It is a somatic response. I feel it. I feel the divinity relating with me. I feel that passing through me. So I take that out of theology a little bit, and I say, in life itself, when I'm relating to other people, I want to have that kind of curiosity, and in the Greek form, it would be called skepticism. It is inquiry. And so in modern times, we look at skepticism like people who say, oh, well, it's all bullet, you know, it's rubbish. It's, you know, I can prove everything through science. You know, that's sort of a modern take. But there is an ancient form of skepticism that I find to be more valuable. And that is to say, I cannot truly know something, but I can always ask. And I don't necessarily want to rest on any answer. I want to take that answer and use it to ask more questions. And so apophasis, in a way, is to humble yourself again, to say, I know not what I'm dealing with, but I know when it feels like I'm in a flow, either with some work that I'm doing or relating with a person. So, and flow state is obviously very popular in modern culture. It's something people aspire to. And it's when you sort of let go of the register of control, and you just move, like you and I are in conversation, we move into a flow state where we're just going back and forth, sharing ideas and thoughts. And so to me, apophasis enables that, to let go of beliefs and presuppositions about anything, and just be curious and know that when I enter into a conversation with somebody, or if I enter into a task with something, that I let go of any in science, they call it epoché. Yes. Yeah. A scientist has to let go. A good example is if an anthropologist goes to Micronesia and to New Guinea, and they study relatively uncontacted tribal people there. If they are a Methodist from the United States, they don't go there and say, well, these savages have not been, you know, given the gift of Western culture and technology and all these things, and they need to be brought up into the, you know, that if you practice epoché or apophasis, you let that go on the airplane ride, and you arrive in New Guinea and you say, I am a fellow human being. These are fellow human beings. I want to know what they're doing. I want to learn, and I don't want any preconceived notions of what they're doing. So I will check my faith at the door and say, these people are doing what they're doing, and I need. And this way, you extract better information from them. You don't impose upon them, and they will teach you valuable things, because even if they're a quote-unquote primitive culture, they're doing things that our modern culture is really not good at, you know? And you can't scale that. Like, we can't scale a tribe of 300-400 people to billions of people. That in systems complexity science, it's not possible. But anyway, you can learn things and take that back and then share that information. And then put your regular, you know, beliefs back on online and be you, but for that moment. And it's the same thing when doing physics or chemistry, that you can't put any metaphysical assumptions ahead of your work. You have to have a few things that these are the questions I'm asking. Right. These are the questions I'm asking, but I'm not going to already want to know the answer before I do the science.
So the whole point is explore.
Yeah. The whole point of science is to falsify your theory. It's to say, I'm wrong. And okay, then I can throw that out and go to the next thing. So it all kind of culminates in this idea, again, that I would use the ancient definition of skepticism, which is an unending inquiry. And that kind of is what early Buddhism was about. It was just getting to know.
It kind of sounds like coaching a bit as well.
It sounds like what?
Coaching.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. 100%. Because coaching is.
That's the bed of it. Like, it's not, there is no answer. There's no right. There's no preconception. We're just going, and then together, as the coach and the coachee, we're going to find a solution. Yeah. And it's more like the solution is already embedded in the person.
Yeah.
You as a coach are just using the curiosity as a tool to help them see it. And they're like, oh, I didn't think about that
before. Yeah, that's a good coach. And I always say that coaching is Socratic inquiry. Socrates, when he would debate people, he never made declarative statements. He would just ask question after question after question until the person proved themselves wrong. Or in the case of a coaching client, they pull the answer out of themselves because they're the only one that knows the answer to what might seem like an insoluble question. They come to you and they're like, I can't do this or I can't figure this out. And you're like, if you're good at coaching, you'll question. I got new information. Question. So
love it. Yeah. I'm just like, that's my new love. That's it right there.
Well, you know, not to sound critical of Western culture, but I am critical of Western culture. One thing we've lost in Western, so I'll say European and American thinking, is the idea of extracting knowledge in ways that are not, to now speak against science a little bit, in that sort of propositional way where everything can be defined by equations or there's an absolute hard truth. And we have to open up more in the West, and we have to understand that things that may seem paradoxical or things that may seem to be in deep contention with each other are actually on a spectrum. They can oscillate back and forth, and that there is vagary in the middle. So it's that middle way, the middle ground of knowing. And so knowing can be, again, propositional, like a hard, you know, A plus B equals C, and that's it. It's irrefutable. And I will fight you to the death to prove my point, you know, whereas there are other ways of knowing, which, you know, there's a perspectival knowing where you can say, well, I want to listen to your perspective. And then together we're going to synthesize something new and move that. And then we'll both have that perspective. Or there's participatory knowing where we're going to share information and learn from each other. And then again, synthesize something out of that. And then there's participatory knowing, or did I say that already? What's the other? Procedural knowing. Procedural knowing was the one I was trying to pull out. And procedural is what's the right way to understand and learn something. So again, Western culture is very much enmeshed in intelligence, but that's it. And so we have to have a little wisdom in that intelligence. And that again is what philosophy is. I joke that intelligence in the West is like building a sports car. 1,000 horsepower engine, best tires on the market, can go 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds, right? But they didn't put a steering wheel or brakes on it. It can just go 300 miles an hour, but there's no steering wheel or brakes. And so the 1,000 horsepower engine is intelligence, and the steering and the brakes is wisdom, you know, or prudence or discretion or participatory, like sharing ideas and not being rigid and locked into what you think is right. You know, it's like, if that's a good metaphor, it's like building a race car without brakes or steering. Think about it. Do you really want to hit the gas on that thing? And that's where we find ourselves in the West, is we're all about intelligence. We're all about technology. We're all about solving problems through hard facts and all this and that. But there are more subtle ways, I think, to suss out, to refine, just like coaching, to extract. So I'm on a bit of a tangent with that, but I think it's...
But I mean, it's been a fantastic conversation, and I really want to say thank you for just being so fluid, you know, with, you know, the things that you've shared, and for sharing your story as well. And for just, you know, the best part for me, I don't know about you guys, if you're listening, let me know. If you're watching, let me know in the comments, or, you know, send me a message. What was the best part of this conversation for you? Because for me, it's just that ability to kind of have like an aerial view of what is and be aware of what is. And taking on the responsibility to say, okay, I'm aware of what is. And in the parts where I have control, I'm going to try my best to say that, you know, I'm doing what I can to manage the situation in such a way that is not harmful either to me or to those around me. And I think that is such a great skill that you have mastered. Maybe not mastered, but like you're really good at it. And I love how, you know, you were able to put this conversation together, and it's such a beautiful thing to be a part of. So thank you so much, Justin, for coming on the show and for sharing.
Ejiro, thank you for opening up this space for the two of us, and we created something together, and I want to honor that and honor you for creating that space, as well as the audience for their being here as passive participants in this. So And you know, one last little insertion that we had talked about before we hit record, and that is to anyone listening, that a lot of times stories about self-improvement or transformation kind of land on a hard spot. And I'll say to the audience, it's a continuum. It's a forever process. You will be doing this eternally. You know, every great master, every great teacher. I mean, look at Jesus. He walked a very diverse path. The Buddha walked a very diverse path. Muhammad walked a very diverse path. They were humans, and they never arrived at one place. They were always in a continuum. So I would say that if you're doing a self-improvement practice, or you're trying to up things for yourself, that it's continual.
There is never like there, yeah. I'm here now.
Right. Don't expect that.
To be next.
Yeah. Because that can lead to suffering in its own right. Yeah. So just keep going. Surround yourself with beautiful people that can support you. That would be the best advice I could give. So again, Ijiro, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Grazie. Thank you.
Of course. Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, guys. I really do hope that you've learned a lot from this very philosophical and deep conversation with Justin. I hope that it has opened up your awareness somehow to see that, you know, there are multiple ways to see life. Life is really like a prism. It depends on where you're standing, your perspective from there. But then acknowledging that your perspective is not the only perspective there is such a fluid way to live and to learn, because that way you know that whoever you're in conversation with per time, you're able to pause and say, okay, maybe I need to see what you're saying from your perspective. And when you do that, it just makes us all better people, because then we're able to grow together, learn from each other, and just make better decisions in life. So I really do hope you found good value. I did, and I hope you did too. So please reach out to me with your messages, with your feedback. If you're not yet subscribed, please subscribe, and let me get your questions if you have some as well. And of course, if you need to reach out to Justin as well, you can. I'm going to, you know, share his link to LinkedIn here, and a link to his show as well if you want to listen to other conversations that he has had with his guest as well. All right. Until I come your way again next week with another guest on another scintillating conversation on the Stretch Street podcast. This is the Energetic EJ, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.